Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is the Win Tracy recording at 4:43 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time, and today is March 2nd, and of course being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I'm just back from Dubai, so it's been a rather busy week, but I'm looking forward to discussing a number of important topics in this broadcast. And I think that this graphic that of the quantity of bonds that are going to be issued within the next 5 years is perhaps one of the most important considerations that we have to take into account when we begin to think about the longer term, because 2017 was a pretty big year for bond issuance, but 2018 is going to be 50% larger at $1.5 trillion, and in 2019 it's going to be closer to $2 trillion, and by 2021 it'll be $2.5 trillion. So we are now entering the period of time where the quantity of debt that is going to be hitting the markets is going to be going up. Well, what I am very much reminded of is that all the way back in 2003, David coined the phrase supply inelasticity meets rising demand, and that was what characterized the bull market in commodities. That China entered the global economy as a major consumer. There was not the vast majority of the miners were incapable of accelerating the pace at which they could produce whatever they were mining for, and prices surged higher. And this represents the polar opposite of that condition. We are now in a situation where quantity of debt that is being bought by the major central banks is about to start declining, and the quantity of debt that they need to issue is increasing. Well, if that is indeed the case, it is reasonable to anticipate that we are going to see lower prices, and not on a short-term basis, but that this is going to be a significant factor all the way out until at least 2022. And that's assuming that we don't get any additional new spending measures. Well, at least there was some poo-pooing of the infrastructure bill on Capitol Hill in the USA this week. But nonetheless, there is a substantial quantity of additional new debt that is going to need to be to either be refinanced or issued in the next 5 years. So when we think about it in those terms, there is, I think, another big consideration is exactly what kind of debt is going to be how much additional new debt is going to come out. And the incremental new debt in the 2 to 5 year range is by far the highest in 2015. Bills are also, there's going to be a lot of additional bills, over 200 million in bills. But it's in these shorter term time frames. When you go out to the 30 years and to TIPS, there's no additional supply. So let's look at TIPS. TIPS are Treasury Inflation Protected Securities and forward rate notes. There's no additional supply this year. I think that's a major consideration, because what that tells us then is that when we think about what is the outlook for inflation, we should really be looking at TIPS. TIPS are supposed to be inflation protected, and to a greater or lesser extent they are, because the kind of CPI that they are pegged to is real CPI. It's the CPI that, if you were to think about, it's the unchained, it includes lots of the things that are inconvenient. It's what one would consider real inflation. And we have clear evidence here of a very well-defined range. The range is pretty much between 0 3/4% of 1%, and it's been going on already for upwards of 5 years. And it is almost inevitable that it is going to be resolved on the upside. Now, quite whether it is resolved on the upside in March or April is beside the point. Maybe it is May or June. But considering the quantity of additional new debt that is coming into the market, and the fact that it is coming into the market as a result of fiscal profligacy, is directly inflationary. It is, I think, in many respects, I saw this really powerful graphic in a New Yorker article, and it was really about the scourge of the opioid crisis. But when we think about that in different terms, and we think about what exactly does this long-term trend in U.S. Treasuries mean? When we're pretty familiar with the fact that this long-term downward trend in Treasury yields has been going on since the early 1980s, and that it has been as a result of the rise of globalization and technological innovation. And in many respects, it is the graphic representation of disintermediation. So those two factors combined have led to the rise of the emerging markets. Prior to the 1980s, emerging markets didn't do very much of anything. But with globalization and the ability to grow their way out of trouble by adopting capitalist economic models, then we've seen literally billions of people lifted out of poverty and into the middle classes. Technological innovation has allowed them to also skip whole stages of development, and this is not something that's about to change anytime soon. The fact is that because of technological innovation, emerging markets are rapidly emerging and becoming middle-income and high-income countries because they're adopting the same kinds of technology that developed countries had or have, and they are able to employ it at somewhat lower costs, either because of energy being lower or labor being lower. But both of those trends of globalization and technological innovation have contributed to the widening gap between rich and poor, and not least because of the hollowing out of the middle class. And the opioid crisis is, I think, just one symptom of a much bigger theme, in much the same way that the rise of populism, and or where people refer to it as the rise of xenophobia or racism or anti-immigration, well, that is also a symptom of this hollowing out of the middle class, that people are asking these very simple questions, which I think anybody can identify with, which is, what about me? When people have experienced this loss of living standards, where they haven't seen their wages rise or their standard of living improve for a considerable period of time. And when we look at the chart pattern, there is a clearly defined range over the course of the last 5 years. And 3% represents the, I think, an important touchstone in terms of the upper side of this base formation, because it is where we had support being found during the taper tantrum back in 2013. But the fact is that this range has been in evolution since about 2011, so it's already 7 years in formation. So some people think that, and these are the people that do not look at charts, think that the yield peaked in 2016, but that's because they don't know what a failed downside break looks like, that this has been ranging for considerably longer than that, and there is the realistic possibility that it is now ending. One of the other ways of looking at this market is with the Merrill Lynch Total Return Index for U.S. Treasury futures. And when you look at this on a long-term chart, you can see that it pretty much only went up. And now it's no longer going up. It has lost momentum over the course of the last 5 years, and it is increasingly got type 3 trend-ending characteristics, which are characterized by ranging time and size. It's coming down to the neckline of this type 3 top, and a sustained move below 2050 would suggest that we are in the topping phase. That would probably, excuse me, the top completion phase, and that would probably also be associated with a move above 3%. But If we go back and think about the quantity of debt that needs to be issued over the course of the next 5 years, it's almost inevitable that the total return on bonds is going to break down. And that when we consider that yields have been so very low, it has been the momentum trade that has sustained the advance in the total return. Well, if the momentum comes out of bonds and prices fall faster than yields appreciate, then we are going to see the total return on bonds reverse. I was rather taken aback at a meeting I went to a few years ago where I was chatting with one of the salespeople at Double Line, and I mentioned this total return on bonds, and he said, and obviously he was more in the sales department than the asset management department, saying, but maybe it's impossible for that to turn around. Well, if that doesn't tell you about the complacency in the market, nothing does. There is absolutely no market that only goes up. And it is simply that the bond market has been going up for such a long time that people have absolutely no conception at all about the potential for a bond bear market and what that can mean for other assets. I'm reading The Three Body Problem at the moment. It's a science fiction novel about trying to make sense of something that is completely beyond one's experience. And it is just another way of thinking about this type of environment, because it has been almost 40 years since we have had a bond bear market, and people simply don't remember how to deal with it. Well, the types of things that do well in an inflationary environment are hard assets, and property is certainly in there with a fighting chance, because fixed, and particularly fixed assets with fixed interest rates, tend to do well. The US economy has got Fannie and Freddie Mae, so they have fixed mortgage rates, and there is the potential that if we get an inflationary bias coming through, well, then the price of everything goes up, wages go up, and that puts upward pressure on property. At the same time, we are starting to see at least some evidence that there should be some pricing pressure coming into the cost of building houses, because lumber prices are at new all-time highs. This has been an incredibly cyclical market for a significant amount of time. Well, the NAFTA negotiations between the Trump administration and Canada are continuing, and this is the first market that we've seen where there has been some clear evidence that the more protectionist approach that the US government is taking is having an effect on commodity prices. Well, in here this week, we also saw that the steel sector was coming under the spotlight, and US steel has been ranging below $50 since 2011, and it is now right in the region of that level. Now, it is rather overbought in the short term, so we may get some pause, but this imposition of tariffs on imports is a significant development. Well, if we look then at ArcelorMittal, that has resulted in it coming back towards the region of the trend mean in here today. So we're definitely getting some differences depending on how much various companies export to the US. Then aluminium prices have been trending higher for 2 years already, and they are now right back in the region of the trend mean. When we look at the LME Metals Index, then it is also still trending higher, although we are currently in another process of consolidation following that breakout that we had at the beginning of this year. Well, commodities do generally tend to do best in an inflationary environment, because the cost of just about everything rises. And when we look at the continuous commodity index, which is an unleveraged index and unweighted index, and therefore we can see clearly that it is not performing like the industrial metals. The industrial metals have been doing all the running in the commodity sector, but the agricultural commodities have been very inert. But this week, we're starting to see corn taking off here. And It is now pushing back up towards the upper side of this evolving 4-year range. And then we can look at wheat, and it is also looking increasingly likely that 400 is the lower side of this base formation. And soybeans are also rallying up and away from what is the lower side of an almost 4-year base formation. Cotton prices have also been really quite depressed, and they're also starting to rally here. So this is increasingly looking like a broad-based move in some of the food commodities. Then the laggards are still coffee, and cocoa has just now this week broken its progression of lower rally highs again, and is looking increasingly likely that it will be able to hold that $2,000 level and improve upon it. The number of food commodities that are beginning to exhibit either base formation characteristics or are breaking up out of those bases is improving, and therefore, what that is, I think, contributing to is this question about whether we're going to see additional upside. Well, oil prices were really very consistent all the way up from June to about the beginning of February. Then they experienced a much larger pullback, and they're currently trading around $64. Well, this was an inconsistency in terms of that very consistent advance upwards from June. And then it bounced from above $60. And that $60 is a big psychological Rubicon. If we were to see prices moving above 70, well, then there's going to be a lot more additional supply coming into the market. But what it does look like is that everybody knows that. And the likelihood, therefore, is that we are going to see prices probably ranging between about $60 and $70 for a while. And it would really require some sort of, I think, a geopolitical event to see prices sustainably above $70, considering just how much additional new supply can be brought online, particularly from the shale properties in the USA. We can also see that that oil prices are in backwardation, and what that also helps to confirm is that there is a short-term bias upwards in prices. That, and when we think about how much can these shale producers hedge, well, they can hedge out to February 2020 at $58. If prices were back up towards 70, they'd be hedging out at closer to $65. And if they get $65 out to 2 years, then I think they'd be more than happy. They would drill all day, all week, all month for about $65 and still be making money. So what that means is the higher prices go, the greater the likelihood that we're going to see prices coming back down on a sustained basis. And when we think about the longer term, I saw interesting stories before I jumped on the plane this morning where aqueous batteries are charging very quickly and have got upwards of 200 times the energy density of lithium-ion batteries for the kinds of batteries that go into phones. And that's a massive technological innovation, and it's based on graphene, and they anticipate that it will be easy to manufacture. Well, this kind of technology is coming out of South Korea, and considering that South Korea is one of the areas where there is a significant quantity of phones being produced, they are obviously looking to really get down to the clear areas where they can have an advantage. And battery technology is a massive technological innovation that is going to upset the energy sector for the foreseeable future. And this isn't something that's going to go away either. So we can still talk about the energy sector, and we can still talk about the profitability of companies around the $65 area, but perhaps the more important point is that when we look out to 10 years, that there is going to be an upset in the crack spread, that there will not be the same call for gasoline, and that investors will be looking more towards other sources of fuel, not least the marine fuel, or for diesel in terms of locomotives. But even the problems for even when one thinks about those types of end uses, the harsh reality is that the energy density of batteries is improving approximately every 5 years. So it doubles in 5 years, it would be up 4 times within 10 years. And electric batteries are pretty much there already in terms of fulfilling a lot of the range anxiety that most people have. You're not yet going to be able to drive coast to coast without stopping to recharge, but there is the realistic possibility that that will be possible at some point within the decade, for the simple reason that the chemistry of batteries is improving all the time. Well, when we think about it in those terms, then that is creating a supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment in a certain part of the commodity complex. But it's within the producers of the kinds of metals that are required for those batteries. So when we look at, for example, Orocobre, it was able to surge higher over the course of the last 6 months because its primary business is mining lithium. And Katanga is Glencore's big bet on cobalt in the DRC. Sherritt International is a nickel miner that also has copper as a byproduct, and it's now in the region of its trend mean. But commodities generally are beneficiaries of a more inflationary environment. Considering that it was record low interest rates and massive abundance of credit that contributed to the deflationary environment, then potentially higher interest rates will contribute more to an inflationary environment because it forces people to go out and invest. When we think about then what are the other things that benefit from an inflationary outlook? Well, at least some people will be thinking about gold. And I think that it is important to really think about gold in terms of exactly when does it do best? And gold does best in an environment where you have negative real interest rates. You can have negative real interest rates in a deflationary environment because interest rates are practically zero. But when you have an inflationary bias, then for gold to do really well, it has to be going up at a period of time where inflation is outpacing at the rate at which central banks are raising interest rates. There is the realistic possibility that that might yet occur, but it's not happening just yet, and that is why gold prices are still range bound. When we look at the commonality that we have in so many of these charts, that gold prices have been ranging below $1,400 since 2013, and US 10-year treasuries have been ranging below 3% since at least 2013, and I think more like 2011. TIPS have been ranging below 75 basis points for about 4 years, so it's the end of 2013 and the beginning of 2014. And it isn't unreasonable to conclude that when one of these goals, it will probably take the others with it. The continuous commodity index has been ranging for about 2 years. And when we look at the fact that you have treasuries and TIPS and gold and the broad commodity complex, all with relatively similar patterns, that's clear commonality, which we can then draw the thread of commonality between them and conclude that that is where inflation is most likely to be felt. We know that there's going to be a great deal of additional supply, and that the reason that there's going to be so much additional supply is because that we are getting a transition from monetary accommodation to fiscal accommodation. And this question that is being asked in just about all democracies, what about me, is the way that politicians respond to that question is either to cut taxes or to stoke nationalist fervor or to raise wages or a bit of all three. And that's exactly what we're starting to see. So again, these are, I think, very important themes. They're all interlinked, and this is the kind of change that is secular in nature. It is, I think, one of the most important characteristics. I remember when I was writing Crowd Money that the reason that I was looking at these big companies with global orientation and strong cash flows, often, although certainly not exclusively, but often with long records of increasing their dividends. And because they were these bigger companies, they were also leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. They would benefit from the revolution that we're getting in the energy sector, and they also are some of the beneficiaries of technological innovation, because not only are some of them technology companies themselves, but that they are the purchasers of some of that technology, and therefore they gain all of the productivity benefits as well. Well, if we want to look at a long-term chart of consumer discretion or consumer staples, well, consumer staples is an index that is composed of a significant number of those types of companies. And it trended higher in an incredibly consistent manner from about 2009. And then it pulled back very sharply from the peak that we saw in early February. And so far, it has not rallied. Now, there are two primary reasons why consumer staples had done so well. Well, one of them is because these are the kinds of companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. And that's certainly true. But because they have such reliable cash flows, they are often considered to have bond-like characteristics. And that was another reason that people were buying them, because they were worried about the loss of purchasing power that that their savings were getting. So by buying these types of companies, they were capturing yield and the potential for that yield to outpace the total return on bonds. Well, right now the yield on the consumer staples index is 2.98%, and the yield on 10-year treasuries is about 2.9%. And one of the reasons that people own the consumer staples is because of these bond-like characteristics. And what that suggests to me, at least, is that if we do get bond prices deteriorating further and yields pushing above 3%, well, the yield on the consumer staples sector is also likely to increase. And that is either going to be achieved by the companies stepping up their dividend growth models or prices falling to improve the yield. It isn't a, and a, that is, I think, a rather simplistic way of thinking about it. What we can also look at is the charts of the yields on some of these companies. So, for example, if we look at Nestlé, then the yield on Nestlé's share tends to bounce, or that the share price tends to bounce when the yield gets to about 3.5%. So when we look at the share price, it is pulling back towards this 70 franc level. And by the time it gets down towards the 70 to about 67 franc level, that's about where the share is has historically bounced. When we look at something like Procter and Gamble and then look at the yield chart, we can also see that it's about 3.5%. Every time the yield gets to approximately 3.5%, that's where the share begins to rally. And we're not that far off it now. So that's, I think, another interesting characteristic, that considering that these are the kinds of companies that have got big global businesses, and in an inflationary environment, they recapture pricing power, then they do have the potential to do well in an inflationary environment. But the fact is that they've already done very well, and they are trading on PEs that are not eye-watering, or excuse me, I shouldn't say eye-watering, mouth-watering, that people are probably willing to wait a while and capture a somewhat higher yield. There's a significant number of these type of dividend aristocrat companies that tend to bounce when their yields get to about 3.5%. I think it's a rather interesting question whether that is going to remain the case when the spread of these companies' yields relative to bonds changes, because the spread is already pretty tight. And if we are in an inflationary environment, then there is potentially an argument that these types of companies would need to have a somewhat more competitive yield in order to recapture investor interest for supporting their initiatives. And that's why I think we do have short-term oversold conditions in a significant number of these shares. So watching where the yields are around this 3.5% level, again, for Coca-Cola, is going to be an instructive exercise, because we definitely see that increasingly we have these short-term oversold conditions, and that these types of companies have not rallied in a dynamic manner. Two of the largest constituents in the consumer staples sector and the consumer discretionary sector are Walmart and Amazon, respectively. Well, Walmart has been investing in its online product, and it has got to do a lot more. Right now, the yield is only at about 2.33%. When it gets to about 3%, that is where people start to step in to buy it. And it has pulled back really very violently. I can definitely tell you from first-hand experience that the online sector, or listing products on Walmart, is painfully difficult, whereas listing products on Amazon is incredibly easy. And when they are trying to encourage more sellers to sell via their web platform, then that is going to remain a challenge. At the same time, we should also look at Amazon, because Amazon is a share that is currently trading at $1,500, and that is a big psychological level. And most particularly, it's a big psychological level when the trend mean is at 1,153. And one of the reasons that people buy Amazon is that it does go up in a very impressive manner, and it is also liable to have some swinging pullbacks. Well, it had a swinging pullback in February, and it rallied all the way up to new highs, and then it pushed on again. One thing that is clearly the case with Amazon is that they are now creating these add-on product designations, that if you're buying a low-value product, that you have to spend at least $25 before you can use Prime to have it sent to you. That is going to increase the average basket, and it will probably contribute to more money being spent generally on Amazon. And I think that that is one of the reasons why the price has been that bit firmer, that Amazon might be trading on a high, and let's be honest about it, 182 is a very high estimated PE, but the reality is that it's still a reasonably consistent advance, and that a break in the medium-term progression of higher reaction lows would be required to question the overall environment. So it is these kinds of companies tend to do well in an inflationary environment, because they can either grow faster than the rate of inflation, and in Amazon's position that is considerably faster than the rate of inflation, or they can increase their dividends at a faster clip, which would also then help to flatter their performance. Then when we think about what are the other markets that tend to do best in an inflationary environment, well, I think the Venezuelan market is a clear example of one that tends to give us a graphic illustration of how stock markets reflect the inflation rate. So if inflationary pressures pick up, then that is positive for stocks in nominal terms. Doesn't necessarily mean that stocks will keep pace on an absolute basis, but in nominal terms, then we can anticipate that stock prices would continue higher. But there is an additional consideration, and it is that we are in the latter stages of a medium-term bull market. And we had a particularly consistent advance between 2016 and the peak in February. And then we had a much larger pullback, and that pullback was not only larger but swifter than anything we'd seen in at least 2 years. Well, then we saw the price get up to 2800, and it certainly steadied in here today after 3 consecutive days in the downside that were rather dynamic in nature. The big question now is whether that low that we've seen today is going to hold. And I continue to think that the most likely scenario is that we are going to see more ranging. That I think is the most likely scenario. And considering that when you get these much larger pullbacks, then people are going to be asking a simple question: has anything really changed? And they're going to be clear and thinking, well, probably not a great deal has changed. We haven't had a lot of fundamentals that have changed negatively. In fact, we've just gone through a pretty impressive earnings season. And it won't be until we start to see bond yields moving up in a significant manner that they become a headwind for equities. What is possible is that this range could persist for 6 or 7 months, and then the index will need to break on the upside to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. There is no secular bull market doesn't have a recession on occasion. Well, right now there is no sign that we're going to have a recession, not least because we've just begun to engage in fiscal profligacy. But the yield curve spread is deteriorating, and it might be another year or two before it moves into negative territory. But in the course of the last 40-odd years, we have not had a U.S. recession without the yield curve going inverted first. The other thing to really keep an eye on, in my opinion at least, is the high yield sector, and high yield spreads have been very tight. So what that suggests is that we might be seeing that bond yields are rising, but so far high yield bonds are not rising faster. But because the yields are rising, then that is contributing to the high yield ETFs, which are based on price, rolling over. And what we may now be seeing is that the ETF is encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean following its unwinding of the majority of its oversold condition relative to the trend mean. So this also is indicative of the potential for greater stress to come into the high yield sector. And a lot of that high yield debt is in the energy sector. So it isn't simply that the faith, or excuse me, the fate of the energy sector is tied to what's going on in the price, but also to interest rates, because unconventional wells are darned expensive to drill, and that is something that is done on an increasing debt load basis. Well, then when we think about what are the other things that are potentially lead indicators for future recessions, you can also look at things like unemployment, which continues to trend lower. It really wouldn't be until it's trending higher that we get into a more inflationary environment. One thing that I think is worth keeping an eye on as well is the velocity of money. Now, this is updated quarterly and in arrears. but it did turn upwards at the last reading, and it hasn't really put in more than two consecutive advances since the early 2000s. And the velocity of money trending lower has ensured that we haven't had inflation, because as long as the velocity of money is deteriorating, you can continue to pour more money into the economy and you will not get an inflationary outcome. It's when you get inflation starting to pick up that then the velocity of money turns around and central banks get much more activist about removing some of that capital. Well, there is absolutely no country in the world has been trying to foment inflation for longer than Japan. And the TOPIX index is now right in the region of the upper side of a over 20-year range. The TOPIX banks index is depressed, and it has pulled back below the trend mean in here this week, and it was off its lows in here today. Personally, I'm waiting for the first upward dynamic before initiating a long position, but this is an index that I want to buy. I want to have a position in Japan because it is not as expensive as Wall Street. In fact, the banks are among the cheapest banks in the world. And the Nikkei is back in the region of the trend mean, and it is perhaps subject to some additional volatility. But as long as it is trading above 20,000, I don't really believe that people are going to be overly concerned with it. One thing that we have seen over the course of the last few weeks has been some strength in the yen, and the dollar was well off its lows in here today. One of the reasons that the yen has been rallying is because of deleveraging and the unwinding of carry trades. The other, of course, is because the USA has engaged now in fiscal profligacy, and Japan has not been running the same kinds of deficits. So when we look at this longer term chart, then we can see that there was a time when the yen was substantially weaker, and then it strengthened substantially all the way from the 70s through until the mid 1990s. And that 100 yen level is a rather large psychological Rubicon, and it really does need to hold it if the potential for base formation evolution and additional upside is to be given the benefit of the doubt. But I am increasingly looking at the Japanese market because I think it is a hedge against an inflationary bias to the global economy. That when we look at the commonality that we have right across these sectors, then this is, I think, a rather interesting environment. Well, the other types of markets that do well in an inflationary environment are those that can grow faster than the rate of inflation. Well, Japan would need inflation to start taking off at a prodigious rate to kickstart demand in the economy. But then you have to look at the Indian market, for example, which has had this continued advance and occasional bouts of volatility over the course of the last few years, but it is now right in the region of the trend mean. This is about where, within the next 300 or 400 points, that if support is to be found, it will be in this area. India is one of the highest growth markets in the world, and I think we can argue that governance is generally improving, that there have been significant additional advances in the Indian market, and that when we think about the rate of digitization that is going on there, then that is likely to act as a significant tailwind to growth for the foreseeable future. Well, if governance is generally benign in places like India and Indonesia, or in the Philippines, despite the fact that you have a populist in charge in the Philippines, I think we can say that governance is, generally speaking, improving. Well, the one place where governance is very clearly not improving is in China. That China is very good at building infrastructure, and there is absolutely no argument with that. But the imposition of single-person power, where previously you had the Politburo, now you will simply have Xi's office. And that is concentrating power in the hands of a single individual. And that is, I think, a retrograde step in terms of governance. Well, one can think about Africa or India, and a lot of people would consider that those are risky markets. But if the trend of governance is improving over time, well, then that would suggest that it might be risky today, but it'll be less risky in future. The problem with China today is that it had somewhat reasonable governance, and that governance is now deteriorating. So we can then ask the question, is it going to be better in future? And the answer is no. And that's simply I think, a value conclusion based on the trajectory of governance. That means that the risks in future will be greater than the risks today. And that is why investing in China now has to come with additional risk warnings. When we look at the A-share index, it has encountered or at least paused in the region of the trend mean and that 3,500 point level. If we look at the Shenzhen B shares, which do not contain banks, then it has been ranging mostly below 1,200 for the last 6 months, and in fact has been pulling back from it in a rather dynamic manner. Then, when we look at the H share index in Hong Kong, well, it got right up to the upper side of its range, and it's now coming back towards this 12,000 level in the region of the trend mean, but it will have to demonstrate support in the region of that trend mean to confirm that the medium-term bullish environment is still intact. And personally, I am not going to participate until I see a clear upward dynamic. And but even then, I am getting increasingly leery of what is going on in China, because it is quite simply a retrograde event in terms of the overall environment. Well, when we think about the march of technology, then it is the FANG shares, most notably Amazon and Apple, Google and Facebook, that have continued to do well. They're all still trading above their respective trend means. But when we look at Google, which had had one of the most consistent trends, where reactions had been limited to $100, pretty much since shortly after the IPO in 2000, or shortly after 2009, well, it's just had a $200 reaction. And so far, it has held above that reaction low. But a sustained move below the trend mean, well, then that would begin to start to look like top formation development. So I think that Google is now something that one really does need to pay attention to. And Apple was pausing in the region of its peak in here this week. And it was pulled back quite sharply yesterday, and it recouped about half of the decline in here today. The technology shares are among those that have bounced back most impressively, and that's clearly an indication that people really do want to own them. And now the question is, are they going to be able to sustain moves up and away from the peaks of the current ranges, or are they going to fail to sustain those upward breaks? This is a big question for the next couple of weeks. But the reality is that we are in a secular bull market, and that the Dow gold ratio gives us a graphic illustration of that relationship between asset classes, between commodities and stocks. There's about 35 years between the peaks. So the next secular peak on Wall Street is likely to be sometime in 2035, and that peak will be higher than the peak that we saw in 1999. And what that would suggest then is that the price of the Dow will be at least 40 to 45 times the price of gold. Well, gold prices already have base formation characteristics. So that could suggest that this ratio will contract somewhat if gold breaks out without the Dow Jones doing anything at all. These are all potential hedges against an inflationary bias. And an inflationary bias would also help to boost nominal prices for stocks, and it would ensure that this long-term ratio does in fact reach fruition at some point in the next 15 years. Well, these are, I think, some of the most important medium-term considerations. That when we think about the return of inflation, then that is something that is going to be processed. It's going to create a significant rotation within markets. And it is a theme that is going to play out over the course of years as opposed to months. Then the march of technological innovation and the rise of the global consumer are unlikely to be affected by that. But the risks that we have in the market are that inflation becomes too much of a problem too quickly, and that protectionism and this ambivalent attitude towards the status quo, and with an increasing number of revolutionary movements arising, that these do represent challenges. And considering that we have been already rallying in stock markets for years already, that this is an important time to monitor the consistency of trends. And I think it is more important to do so now that we are later in the medium-term cycle than it has been at any time since 2009. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.